Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
High on Mount Carmel in Haifa in Israel stands the Shrine of the Bab, surrounded by one of the world's most beautiful gardens. Hello, welcome to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. And this week I invite you to come with me to meet the spokesman for the international Baha'i community, Douglas Moore, in what has to be one of the best addresses in Israel. And you can see pictures of where we are on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. It's ironic that the Baha'is, who cultivate peaceful relations with all religions and who focus their work on ethical teachings and service to the community, have been persistently hounded in their home country, Iran, where they number 300,000. Currently, the Iranian government has detained 7 Baha'i leaders in undisclosed locations, and their families and friends in Australia and elsewhere have been kept in the dark about their fate. Since visiting Haifa and speaking to Douglas Moore, we've learned that a United Nations official has exposed a plan by the authorities to eliminate the Baha'i community in Iran. But high on the slopes of Mount Carmel, where the Baha'i's peak body, the Universal House of Justice, recently met for its elections, the atmosphere was calm and serene. That is, after getting away from the traffic.
We're actually just entering some... We're ascending some stairs adjacent to a fairly busy road in Haifa.
Yeah, it's a very busy road. It's one of the main arteries that takes people from the lower part of the mountain up into the upper part of the mountain and then back into the neighborhoods and the university and so forth. And it's interesting because the gardens were separated for many years by the road, but now there's a bridge that was built over it. And during the time of the construction of the terraces, which concluded in 2001, they had to keep the traffic flowing at the same time as they were building the bridge. But what is accomplished now is that when people visit here, they hardly notice that it's a bridge. They just think it's part of the gardens and it's all one contiguous space.
Well, we've ascended to this beautiful vantage point of the shrine, and right in front of us is a beautiful garden. And actually, the shrine seems to float in space at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it does seem suspended that way from this vantage point because we're looking out with just the bay and then the mountains on the other side of the bay behind the shrine. So, yeah, it does kind of give you that impression.
There's a glass pyramid here that is a kind of a mini pyramid of I.M. Pace in front of the Louvre.
Yeah. Well, not quite that elaborate. It's simply a skylight that brings light in because... What the architect did was for many parts of the terraces and so forth, and the extension of the terraces off to the side there, you see where there's some stone up there and a railing and so forth. Those are also light wells. You can see some skylights there. They're actually offices that are underneath the gardens in some places. And the space that we were just in with the visitor center is actually underneath gardens. So this little pyramid, as you called it, is actually a skylight that brings light into the offices that are down below.
And of course, Doug, while I was looking at the beautiful shrine, I didn't realize that behind me, rising up, how far up is this gorgeous terrace?
It goes right up to the crest of the mountain. It's about 600 meters altogether from base to top, and about a kilometer distance traveled on when you go up the stairs. So we'll go over here where we've got a better vantage point because it gives us a good view of the sweep of the upper terraces.
And what is actually at the top of the stairs?
Well, at the top is just the last terrace and a gate, and that takes you out onto a street called Yefenof. And that's it. The destination, really, of the terraces is really at the center. It's the shrine itself. And you'll notice that the upper terraces are in an arc, and the lower terraces are on a counter arc, so that it looks as if waves are emanating out from the shrine. And you see it especially at night when all of the lamps are illuminated and the shrine is illuminated with spotlights and so forth set off in the midst of these terraces. And you can see arcs on the upper terraces here as we're looking up. And so it looks like waves of light kind of emanating out.
It is astonishingly beautiful. Yeah. Who designed this?
This was a man named Faribor Sahba. He's of Iranian birth. He's a citizen of Canada now. He's an architect. He did some work in Iran and then was commissioned by the Universal House of Justice to build the temple in Delhi, which is known fondly to people in India as the Lotus Temple because it has the appearance of a lotus. People liken it to the Opera House in Sydney with a springing out kind of form. And then he came here, was a designer of the terraces and project manager for the construction here for about 12 years, which also brought the building that you see across the way there, you see it through the trees, that and another building that's behind the International Archives building here were part of the same project. So the undertaking started in about 1989 and was completed in 2001. Two new buildings and the terraces, the upper terraces and the lower terraces around the shrine.
So that building over there, which looks at least from here like a Greek temple, is a recent building?
Yes, it was completed at the end of 2000. All the buildings followed the kind of the keystone design of the International Archives building, which unfortunately we can't see because it's surrounded by these scaffolding and so forth that's undertaking some cleaning and some reinforcement of the foundation. But it's like a small version of the Acropolis. And so this neoclassical design then influenced the other three buildings on the terraces, but in a much less formalized sort of way. As you can see, it's called the International Teaching Center. It bows out. It has a beautiful arced set of windows on the top of the building. The other new building has a circular portico with a fountain in the middle, and it's quite lovely. And then the International Governing Council, as I said, the Universal House of Justice, it has its building at the center, and we'll have a little better vantage point when we get down below.
Before we talk about the Universal House of Justice,
yeah,
can you tell me a little bit more about the garden, some of the motifs? I see rose bushes and also a lot of stars. This is, I think, an eight-pointed star?
It's eight-pointed stars. These were originally conceived by Shoghi Effendi, who was the great-grandson of Baha'u'llah. Shoghi Effendi was the head of the Baha'i faith, the guardian of the Baha'i faith from 1921 till 1957. And he first set out the gardens around the Shrine of the Bab, where we see all the olive trees and the palm trees and the cypress trees. We've got Araucaria, otherwise known as Norfolk pine, a real mix of trees, a beautiful, huge eucalyptus that's over here. So there's a mixture of different kinds of trees. The guardian really planned and set out those first stages of the gardens then that were carried over in the further design of the terraces. And so we see eight-pointed stars. It doesn't have a religious symbolic value to the Baha'is, really just for beautification. We see rose bushes. About 1,200 species of plants and flowers altogether are rotated through the Baha'i gardens here and in Akka. And we see eagles, peacocks. There are even some Chinese monuments, some Chinese dragons. And these were actually just put in place just not necessarily for a specific symbolic reference, but really for what they suggest. The eagle is associated in literature and poetry with vision or with exaltation, loftiness, victory. Peacocks are associated with eternal life and beauty. Dragons with long life and other things associated with Chinese culture that I'm not so sure about myself. But you can see how the inner part of the gardens that follows the stairs is very formal. It's symmetrical, it's balanced from side to side, it's very ordered. But then as you get to the outer part of that formalized garden, there's an informal garden of plants and small trees and shrubs, different colors of flowers. This is referred to as the purple season because there's so much purple in the gardens this time. And then, as you can see, it just blends into the native plants that are already on the mountain. So it doesn't look like something that was necessarily just kind of dropped down in the city, but it's integrated into the rest of the hillside and into the surroundings.
When was the shrine actually built?
Well, there are two shrines that are of importance to the Baha'is. The shrine here is called the Shrine of the Bab. And then the Shrine of Baha'u'llah is directly across the bay in Akka. The Shrine of the Bab, the first stage of it was completed in 1909. The Bab is a forerunner of Baha'u'llah. The Bab was executed before a firing squad of 750 soldiers in Iran. And his remains were not allowed to be buried in a befitting manner. So his followers actually kept them in hiding for decades until they were finally sent here at Baha'u'llah's behest. Baha'u'llah visited this spot as restrictions were relaxed, Baha'u'llah, who had been imprisoned here with his family in Akka when it was a Turkish penal colony, restrictions were gradually relaxed and he was able to move outside of the old city. And he actually visited Haifa on a few occasions and came to the spot marked by the circle of cypress trees, which were there at the time when Baha'u'llah visited here in 1891. And he told his son, Abdul Baha, that this is where the shrine of the Bab should be built when conditions permitted. Baha'u'llah passed away the following year, and Abdul Baha then lived under various degrees of hardship and imprisonment as different changes in administration took place and orders came from Istanbul and so forth, this area then being under the Ottoman Empire. The Young Turks Revolution happened in 1908, releasing all of the religious and political prisoners, Abdul Baha among them, one of the religious prisoners of the Ottomans. And immediately he set about building the first stages of the mausoleum and finally was able to lay the remains of the Bab to rest on New Year's Day, Nowruz, as we call it, which is the first day of spring in the Baha'i calendar, in 1909.
And the shrine across the way in Akko to Baha'u'llah, do they sort of speak to each other, as it were?
Well, it's very interesting that you would ask that question, because as you see the shrine today here, the shrine of the Bab with the gold dome, the colonnade and the beautiful marble and the lancet windows and so forth, 18 in number, recalling the first disciples of the Bab. That was completed in 1953. When Baha'u'llah passed away in 1892, his body was laid to rest in a building right next to his home, which was called Bahçe, which means delight in Persian. So the shrine here of the Bab looks directly across the bay, almost in deference to the shrine of Baha'u'llah. These are the two most holy places in the Baha'i world, the shrine of Baha'u'llah being the holiest. And so the Bab in his writings foretold the coming, prophesied the coming of Baha'u'llah, then referred to himself as being less than the ring on the small finger of him whom God would make manifest, referring to Baha'u'llah. There's such a love that is communicated in the writings of the Bab for Baha'u'llah, anticipating his faith, anticipating his cause. And then as Baha'u'llah developed his writings and reflected also on the Bab, that love was reflected back in his memory. And so these gardens, the shrine, recalls that and makes this space a sanctified space. And so it's in the reflection of those times and those moments, the breadth of Baha'u'llah's revelation, the spiritual power, the God-born force, as he refers to it, that animates Baha'i activity, but also has imparted a spiritual impulse to the recreation of human society. And so the sanctification of this space and the recollection of the holiness of the shrine and so forth is something that Baha'is have built up and put in place for all of humanity. It's not just limited to Baha'is. There are tens of thousands of people who visit the terraces each year. The shrine itself is open to visitors every morning who want to come and pray and reflect there. And the gardens in Akka the same.
Well, this is certainly a wonderful place to come and contemplate the love of God. It's a very positive place, filled with love and beauty. Is that relationship between the Bab and Baha'u'llah the reason why the Baha'is are so focused on beauty, particularly in this natural way, in the beauty of a garden?
I think so. I think that's really a good point, because Baha'u'llah explained that we come to know God, that our purpose in life is to know and to love God. And that to know God, we can't comprehend God. We can't know God's essence. God is an unknowable essence, Baha'u'llah says, in fact. And that it's these manifestations of God, such as the Bab and Baha'u'llah, and before him, Muhammad, Jesus Christ, Moses, Buddha, Krishna, Abraham. Baha'u'llah says that we should make no distinction between them, that they all had the same capacity, all had the same potential, but that they gave their revelations out in measure to the needs and times in which their revelations were revealed. And Baha'u'llah is not the last, he's not the supreme, he's simply the latest, whose teachings are suited to the needs of this age. But he said that one of the things about knowing and loving God is that we learn to know and love God through an understanding of the qualities of God, which is true in any aspect of life. You know, if we were talking about what is the sun, we would talk about its heat and its intensity and its light and its impact on life on earth. So we're describing it in terms of what it does, what its impact is, without really knowing, well, really what the essence of it is, really. And similarly with God, we come to learn God through his qualities and attributes, which are latent within us, and which we then can bring into action through good times as well as through difficult times, that we are tested, and that through these tests and difficulties, we respond in a spiritual manner, and we learn how to become more loving, more compassionate, more just, more fair-minded, more knowledgeable, more powerful in a good sense, not in the ego sense, and learn to fight the spiritual battle that takes place within ourselves between oneself and one's ego. And one of the names of God, Baha'u'llah says, is beauty, the beauty of God. And in fact, Baha'u'llah is referred to in the writings as the blessed beauty, that he reflects the beauty of God himself, as all of the previous messengers of God or manifestations of God did, like perfect mirrors. That if you look at the mirror reflecting the light of and intensity of the sun, you could say the sun is in the mirror. But in fact, it's not. The mirror is but a reflection of the sun, which is in the sky. But it nevertheless brings the power of the light and the heat and the life-giving qualities to humanity in measure suited to our capacity at this time to undertake it. So, yeah, beauty is very important. But it's not an object of worship in any way approaching idolatry or anything like that. It's we believe, a reflection of the beauty of God, but also a reflection of what humanity is capable of in creating in our social and cultural life on a global scale, the kind of beauty and the kind of refinement that we see reflected here in the gardens.
Douglas Moore, relating the beauty of the Baha'i gardens in Haifa to the Baha'i ethic of creating a harmonious world. Douglas Moore is the Director of Public Information at the World Headquarters for the Baha'i International Community. And before that, he was living in Alaska and was a radio broadcaster. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and online, where you can hear the program straight from your computer or download it onto your personal player. Just go to abc.net.au/rn/Spirit of Things. Now, back to Mount Carmel in Haifa, where I'm speaking to Douglas Moore, right in front of the Shrine of the Bab, the second holiest site for the Baha'is.
You talked about meeting the challenges of life, and certainly the Baha'is in Iran and in other Muslim countries are being challenged quite severely.
Yeah.
How do they cope with the persecution that they have undergone, the killings, the repression?
Well, that's a good question. I think they cling tenaciously to their faith, to their prayers, to their devotion, to their firm attachment to the covenant that Baha'u'llah has made with his believers, that to live one's life according to the teachings of Baha'u'llah brings with it divine assistance. That's the agreement, if you will. That's the covenant that Baha'u'llah enters into when someone declares himself or herself a Baha'i.
Can I ask you about that covenant? Because in the Jewish faith, it's been spelled out in the Torah and then elaborated in the Talmud. In Christianity, the New Testament has Jesus stating in various ways what the covenant means according to him. What does it mean for the Baha'is?
Should we walk down so we can be closer to the shrine and maybe away from the road a little bit? The covenant is a concept, of course, that's been in all the religions. Baha'is see the covenant as actually having two aspects. One is that there's a greater covenant that God has made with man. It was stated to Abraham that God would never leave man alone. And that in Baha'i belief, each of the manifestations of God, or messengers of God, as you call them, makes a covenant with his followers. And covenant in the sense that we're speaking of, in the religious sense, is like a binding agreement that binds man to God, binds the human being to God. Each of these manifestations of God renews the covenant and places it in a contemporary context. And this is what Baha'is believe that Baha'u'llah has done since his coming in the middle of the 19th century, and his announcement and his writings and his scriptures and so forth. He's made a new covenant with humanity. And within each individual then is the capacity to recognize reality, to recognize truth for himself or herself, and to live according to that truth. And this is what a declaration of Baha'i belief is to say, I, as an individual human being, recognize Baha'u'llah for who he says he is, as a manifestation of God, as the mouthpiece of God, as the divine educator. And I commit myself to live according to his laws and his teachings. So this declaration of belief is really, in simple form, a statement of the covenant.
So people are not born into the Baha'i faith. They must actually make a commitment to it. At what age?
Well, that's a good point, at the age of 15. Children in Baha'i families, of course, are raised as Baha'is. They're taught the prayers, they're taught the teachings. Abdu'l-Baha says that the first thing that the child should be taught is courtesy. We teach our children according to the Baha'i teachings. But at the age of 15 then, they enter what Baha'u'llah says is the age of maturity. They become responsible to do the fast, for example, to recite their obligatory prayers, to keep the laws and teachings, to study the writings, to choose a course in life that reflects spiritual aims and attributes and a service orientation. So at the age of maturity, then, one, in effect, affirms that he or she is a Baha'i.
Does the fast in the Baha'i faith reflect its origins in Islam as a kind of offshoot of Shiite Islam?
Well, it reflects the fasts that have been a part of all the divine revelations, of all the religions, that there has always been prayer and there's always been fasting. And Baha'u'llah says that they're like twin pillars of faith and spiritual enrichment. Well, so this period of fasting is somewhat similar to the Islamic fast, Ramadan, in that it's fasting, abstaining from food and drink during daylight hours. It lasts only for 19 days relative to Ramadan, which is 30 days, and it's on the solar calendar, so it's at a fixed time each year.
What is the significance of 19?
Well, 19 shows up a lot in the Baha'i faith.
I think it also shows up in Islam.
Oh?
In the Quran, at least there are some people who argue that 19 is an important number.
19 is all over the place, and 19 times 19 times 19. Yeah, I've read some of those articles and opinions and so forth, and that is a very interesting characteristic, isn't it? But 19 shows up here on the terraces, for example. There are 19 terraces. There, in the Baha'i calendar, there are 19 months of 19 days each. The fast lasts for 19 days. The first followers of the Bab were 18 in number, and together with him formed 19. 19, you know, in the Semitic languages, in Arabic and Persian and Hebrew, in Hebrew it's called Gimatria. In Arabic it's called Abjad. And this is a reckoning of letters with a numeric value, so that a letter equals a number. And so it's used as a poetic device, a literary device, to refer to two people at the same time whose names share the same numeric value like that. Or to refer to a time that also refers to somebody's name. And so it's really, just for symbolic purposes, it's not a metaphysical construct necessarily. And so the number for the word oneness or unity in Persian, which is Vahed, is 19. The number of Baha, which is the root of Baha'u'llah's name, the root of Baha'i, is 9. So there's even some interplay that you can do there, poetically. So there are 9 terraces below and 9 terraces above. There are 19 altogether. When the Baha'is contribute to the funds, they're to do so sacrificially and generously to the regular fund. And there's also a fund called the Right of God, where you calculate your needful expenses and what you must spend on those things. And then what you have left over, you're to pay 19% to the Right of God fund.
What happens if you really can't do it?
If you can't do that, you can't do it. Everyone, of course, can give something to a fund, but if you calculate your needful expenses and you have nothing left over, then you're not obligated. It's a matter of conscience, just like the prayers or keeping the fast or abstaining from alcohol. These are all matters of conscience to individuals. Contributing to the Right of God is calculated on the basis of your best judgment as an individual. There's no formulaic approach. And that's the beauty of the faith, is that it makes so much sense in so many dimensions that you can't have one fixed formula for all of humanity with the diversity of the human race, people living in villages and people living in great urban centers. You know, it can't be the same for everybody.
It must be quite an experience for people living in villages in other parts of the world to come here on pilgrimage. Tell me about pilgrimage and how often it's done. I'm wondering whether it has any parallel to, say, the Hajj, where people go to Mecca, or Christians who go to Jerusalem. However, in the latter case, that's pretty much voluntary. People just do it if they decide to take a holiday to Israel. But how much does pilgrimage figure in the Baha'i faith?
It's pretty central to one's Baha'i experience. Baha'u'llah says that we should try to make a pilgrimage once in our lives if we can afford to do so. And he makes it an obligation for men, actually. So it's very central to one's Baha'i life to come here to be connected in a way that is tactile, that is sensory, and is also a mystical experience to visit the shrines and to have the sense of the place.
Doug, is there a particular route that a pilgrim would follow, places he would go? Can you tell me what the average pilgrim would do?
There's not a specific route, like, you know, the 12 stages of the cross or whatever. I'm not sure what it's called.
Via Dolorosa. yes,
the
in Jerusalem.
Dolorosa. Pardon me. But there are places that are regarded as holy places. There are the two shrines, the Shrine of the Bab and the Shrine of Baha'u'llah. Inside the Shrine of the Bab is also the Shrine of Abdul Baha, where his remains are laid to rest. And these are places of prayer and meditation. There are no rites or rituals that are to be performed there. It's simply a place for an individual believer or an individual to enter and offer one's prayers and reflections and to pay honor to the memory of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. So the pilgrimage program leaves a lot of time for visiting the Baha'i shrines just on one's own. And then there are also visits and meetings with the members of the Universal House of Justice, meeting other people who are appointed to service here, who are called consular members of the International Teaching Center, who help guide and direct the affairs of the Baha'i community. They work on behalf of the Universal House of Justice to counsel national communities in their development. So they would meet them. But then they would also visit other holy places, the prison cell where Baha'u'llah and his family were kept for a little more than 2 years, where Baha'u'llah's younger son died as a result of an accident within the prison.
And that was in Akko.
This was in Akko, yeah, which was then a penal colony. This was the first place where Baha'u'llah arrived with his family in 1868 in the Holy Land, after having been exiled, banished from Iran to Baghdad, where he was for 10 years, and then to Istanbul, and then to Edirne in what is now Turkey, but then was all part of the Ottoman Empire. So those holy places, the prison cell itself, the house that Baha'u'llah and his family were able to move to outside the prison, but still within the prison city, and then the house outside the prison city, as restrictions were gradually relaxed almost altogether, while still a prisoner, while still under certain constraints from the government. And then finally to Bahchi, which is a large house, a mansion really, but also, you remember, it housed a good number of people. And next to which then now is the Shrine of Baha'u'llah. So the pilgrims will visit all of these places. They'll get to know each other. And they're usually from so many different countries and backgrounds that that is part of the experience itself. And then spend time, as much time as they can, in the shrines. Yeah.
Douglas Moore, can you tell me what took place here fairly recently at the Universal House of Justice?
Yeah, the Baha'i faith is administered, led, if you will, by elected councils at the local, national, and international level. And then there are also people who are appointed to terms to serve as advisors or counselors or assistants to communities in their development at those different levels. But every 5 years, we see the election of the International Governing Council, which is called the Universal House of Justice. And that convention takes place here in Haifa, where delegates from all of the national communities come to elect the House of Justice, as well as to consult together on the affairs of the Baha'i community and its plans and programs for growth and development.
What were some of the issues on top of the agenda this time?
Well, foremost among the issues are the education of children, the moral education of children and youth, the development of study circles as we implement a global study program so that we really have a well-educated following, so that the Baha'is themselves really understand in depth what the faith is about, and not just as an insular movement, but as a vehicle for service to humanity as something that has a positive, animating influence on human society. And then hosting of devotional gatherings, that this is really serves as the core of a community's development, is the devotional character, the spirit around which, the fire around which people gather, if you will. And then social and economic development projects that have been undertaken by some 1,200 Baha'i communities around the world, tutorial schools, projects for the advancement of women, human rights activities, and other kinds of educational activities that the Baha'is are undertaking. These really constituted the basis for the consultation at this year's convention.
And what about the issues of persecution of Baha'i communities in Muslim lands?
Well, this was definitely present when they read the roll call. See, the delegates are the members of the nationally elected National Spiritual Assemblies. So those who were here are called up. It's the National Spiritual Assembly of Albania, for example, and then the names of each of the delegates is announced. And they take their turn to put their ballot, which has been written out in a prayerful setting without any campaigning or nominations. They put the 9 people that they feel best qualified to serve on the Universal House of Justice, the 9 men that are best qualified to serve on the Universal House of Justice. So when it came to countries where Baha'is are like Iran, there was a noticeable absence. The Baha'is of Iran asked if there could be a bouquet of red roses presented to the convention on its behalf, and this was done. And so there was this constant reminder in this huge bouquet of beautiful red roses right in the center of the stage of the convention. That was a reminder of the situation of the Baha'is in Iran and the situation of Baha'is in other countries, but not nearly so severe as what's happening in Iran.
Well, that's a very sad reminder of the pain there and the blood that runs at times. Are there strategies in place? I mean, do you talk about what can be done?
Yes, we certainly do. We have a publicity campaign underway, particularly for the students who are denied their education at the college level and who are being harassed at the high school or elementary grades. There's a tremendous amount of work being done by Baha'i representatives with their national governments, in the European Union, in North America, in Australia, who take the lead on resolutions before the United Nations in defense of the Baha'is, calling on Iran to extend its protection of its human rights to the Baha'is. It's a matter that's constantly on the agenda of the UN Human Rights Council and other United Nations agencies, and on the minds of many foreign ministers and their human rights departments within a number of national governments. So trying to really achieve the emancipation of the rights of the Baha'is to freely practice their religion and their beliefs is something that has been really pursued in earnest since the revolution in 1979.
What about the relationship of Baha'is to other Israelis in this country, in Israel, where the Universal House of Justice sits and has done for so many years and decades? Israel has just celebrated its 60th anniversary.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between Baha'is and the State of Israel?
Well, the relationship of the Baha'i international community, the Universal House of Justice, the Baha'i World Center, to the State of Israel has been very positive. There's an understanding that's reached that this is the international headquarters for global religion, and therefore the Israeli government extends to the Baha'i World Center certain rights and privileges that such an international religious center would motivate. So relations are good with the government.
Baha'is are Israeli citizens?
Well, no, we're temporary residents. Interestingly, Baha'u'llah, when he arrived in 1868, instructed his followers not to promote the faith in the Holy Land. And so as a result, there's never been any kind of teaching of the Baha'i faith in Israel or other parts of the region.
Why is that? I mean, I understand that Israel has a ban on proselytizing to Jews.
Yeah.
Does that come into it?
It's not a part of that. It dates back to when Baha'u'llah arrived here, and he stated it as a command, and at the time, we don't know why he gave that command at the time.
There hasn't been any reflection or desire to extrapolate from that command?
Well, one can see perhaps some of the wisdom of that over time, that this is the international center whose affairs are mostly conducted outside of Israel. Of course, this was stated by Baha'u'llah well before the modern formation of the State of Israel. So perhaps it has had an effect on relations between the Israeli government and the Baha'is in a positive way. But again, you know, that wasn't explicitly stated as a reason for Baha'u'llah saying that.
It sounds like Baha'u'llah was comfortable with the existence of those other traditions which he had kind of incorporated into his own hierarchy or evolution of the faiths. I mean, you have Judaism, you have Christianity, you have Islam. They are part of a sort of a hierarchical vision, if I can put it that way, in Baha'u'llah's...
Certainly a progressive, yeah, vision. Baha'u'llah, in fact, uses the term progressive revelation and sees that the oneness of religion is a keystone teaching of the faith, that they differ in their outward form or their outward manifestation or in certain secondary aspects, but at their core they are still animated by the same divine spirit, the same divine reality, the same God. That the oneness of God is reflected in the oneness of religion. God can't be in competition with himself. So when Baha'u'llah looks at the followers of other religions, he states that the Baha'is have a responsibility. If you have a Baha'i village, say, or you have a Baha'i town or a Baha'i state, or envisions a period where there might be a majority population of Baha'is in some place, that it's up to them to protect the rights of minorities and to allow the people to believe as they will. That belief is a matter of conscience, and that the sanctity of one's conscience is inviolate in Baha'i teachings. At the same time, he produces proofs and treatises about his station and how his station is a fulfillment of prophetic visions that are expressed in all the former religions. But there's not to be a prejudice that develops. In fact, in our time, the Universal House of Justice a few years back published a letter to the world's religious leaders calling upon them to recognize their common oneness and to eliminate the basis for division and fanaticism that was sweeping, or that is so much a parcel of our life at the start of the 21st century. So there's this constant call, plea, if you will, to recognize our essential oneness as people of religion, people of God, and that these prejudices should be dispensed with. Because Baha'u'llah warns us that religious fanaticism is a fire that nothing can quench. And you know, we see some of its result today. And so he warns us against that and calls upon his followers to relate to other people of different religions in a spirit of friendliness and concord, is the way he puts it.
Concord, a beautiful word, not heard enough today. Douglas Moore was quoting Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, which is persecuted in Iran, where it originated as a prophetic movement in the 19th century. This is The Spirit of Things, and over the next few weeks, I'll be bringing you some fascinating people I met in Israel. But if you're particularly interested in archaeology, make sure you tune into The Ark on ABC Radio National, Sunday afternoon at 3:45 and Wednesday evening at 8:35, where I uncover ancient sites in Israel throughout June. Coming up soon, a couple of Aussies who've been volunteering at the Baha'i World Center in Haifa. But now back to Douglas Moore, the Director of Public Information for the Baha'i International Community.
Now, this question of progressive revelation, I must ask this of you, and it's probably the most often asked question to Baha'is, and that is the idea that revelation mirrors the times to some extent. Mm. And I wonder to what extent the prohibition on women as members of the Universal House of Justice, those nine are always men.
Yeah.
Baha'u'llah made it clear that they should be men.
Yes.
Is it ever possible for Baha'is to look at Baha'u'llah's commands and see them as contextually relevant to his time, and that perhaps through interpretation they can be slightly altered, but their fundamental thrust can remain?
Yeah. Well, this is a good question, and you're right, it is asked a lot. Baha'u'llah was specific in the Kitab-i Aqdas, his most holy book, the book of his laws, the central book of his revelation, that the Universal House of Justice, not the National Spiritual Assemblies or the local spiritual assemblies or any of the appointed positions for individuals in service to the faith, that the membership of the Universal House of Justice should comprise men. At the start, 9 men, and as many as 19 at some point. At the time, nobody said, well, why is that? Or at least we don't have any recording of that. When Abdu'l-Bahá, who was Baha'u'lláh's appointed interpreter, authoritative interpreter of the writings, was asked this question, he said, in the future, the answer to this question will be as clear as the midday sun. He passed away in 1921, having appointed his grandson, Shoghi Effendi, as the head of the faith, an authoritative interpreter of the writings. And he was asked if this principle would ever change, and he said no, and he was asked why, and he said he referred to Abdu'l-Bahá's statement. For Baha'i, we can't envision a time when that would change. We can envision a time based on what Abdu'l-Bahá said when we would understand why that was.
Has there been any agitation? Is this a question that emerges from within the Baha'i community that you occasionally have to wrestle with, not just impertinent journalists?
Well, you know, people bring it up all the time. They speculate as to why it is, and I think most of the speculation is just kind of bunk. I think it confuses the issue, and a lot of the speculation tends to say something about certain innate characteristics of men and women, and seems to confuse function and role. None of the speculation I've heard makes any sense to me, because Baha'u'llah at the same time said that the equality of men and women has been and always will be a reality before God. Has always been, he said. So how that's expressed through the question of men only on the Universal House of Justice is for me mysterious.
Do you think the Baha'i faith, being so outwardly successful, does it draw to itself a kind of suspicion? Are you the object of conspiracy theories? Do you have people who think, aha, under the shrine there is some vault, and in that vault is some extraordinary, powerful whatever?
Yeah. Did you see this film?
Well, somebody told me about the film.
Well, this was made by a couple of Israeli filmmakers here called Bell Films. It started out as a quest to find out what the Baha'i World Center is all about. One of the directors, having grown up near some Baha'i property in another part of Mount Carmel where there's an obelisk and some gardens. And he wondered what the Baha'i faith is. And he found that when he tried to get into the Baha'i Gardens, in the way that he was trying to get in, he wasn't allowed to get in, although there are tours that are open to the public, and if he'd called our office, we would have been happy to have given him a tour. Be that as it may, the premise of the documentary was that there was something going on underneath the gardens, that there's more to the Baha'i World Center and its properties than meets the eye. So they pursued that, but couldn't come up with anything. We took them on a tour of all of the spaces. There's a tunnel that unites, it's a maintenance tunnel. We took them into the tunnel. We took them into the bomb shelter so that they could see that the bomb shelters were bomb shelters.
Which are pretty common in Israel.
Which have to be built as a part of new buildings under construction. And so they're very common. And offered to take them to, we have there's a parking garage under part of the terraces. But that's all there is. And at the conclusion of the documentary, one of the directors says as her last line, well, sometimes a bomb shelter is just a bomb shelter. As if to say, well, there's really nothing there. Which was, I thought, you know, okay. But they made a lot of claims that they never really produced any kind of documentation for, which is what a documentary should do.
What sort of claims?
Oh, kind of wild claims that Baha'is were real strong backers of the war in Iraq. It was almost like claims that have been made against the Jews, that we have a disproportionate amount of power and influence, that we could provoke the U.S. government to attack Iraq, that there's some kind of secret bunkers under the gardens, under the buildings, that somehow the Baha'is are responsible for the death of a Baha'i who was a weapons inspector in the U.K. And they had people say these things who looked credible but weren't very credible, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we thought it was a bit irresponsible, because throwing mud without being held accountable to back it up. And at the end, then the one director says, well, sometimes a bomb shelter is just a bomb shelter, kind of gave way to the reality of it. And just, so there are these, yeah, there are conspiracy theories, you know. That was probably the boldest of recent times, apart from what's going on in Iran, where Baha'is are accused of being spies, of agents of Zionism, and spies for Israel and the United States. And in former times, we were accused of being spies of Britain or Russia, depending upon who the current enemy of Iran was. So
what's the future for the Baha'i faith? It's obviously spreading its message in parts of the world. How seriously do you think the main faiths take the Baha'i faith?
Well, our numbers are still pretty small, 5 to 6 million worldwide. There are Baha'is in virtually every country, come from every single kind of background. Within the interfaith movement, Baha'is have a seat at the table, if you will. And so there's a recognition that I think on a lot of other religions' part that the Baha'is are legitimate, recognition that it is an independent world religion. And so I think that we've kind of come out of a period of obscurity that shrouded what the Baha'i faith was for probably 100 years. And particularly with the completion of the terraces here in Israel, at the Baha'i holy places, at the Baha'i shrines, it kind of signalized the Baha'i faith kind of stepping into a new stage in its development, and one that is commonly recognized.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, and absolutely a thrill to be here. I never imagined it was this beautiful, and I think many people will hot-foot it here from Australia to have a look for themselves, but we'll certainly show some of it on our website
as
well.
Wonderful. My pleasure, Rachel. Happy to talk to you.
The evening descended, and the lights were on throughout the garden. The shrine of the Bab glowed from within, and I headed back with Douglas Moore to the visitor center to speak to two volunteers from Australia, Nagme and Julia.
Julia, what's a Perth girl doing here in Haifa at the Center for the Baha'i Faith?
I just finished my university degree. I actually sat my last exam a week before I came here. I had always wanted to be a volunteer at the Baha'i World Center. My twin sister actually served here in 2004 for 1 year, and she came home with the most amazing stories of this place and the experiences she had volunteering here for 1 year. I'm actually here for 2.5 years.
And what sort of volunteer work are you doing?
I'm working in the secretariat department, which is in the building called The Seat, which I'm sure you saw. I'm working as a core group assistant, so dealing with a lot of correspondence that comes to and from the Baha'is around the world, and doing a lot of research as well into certain teachings of the Baha'i faith, etc.
I would imagine that being allowed to serve here is quite a privilege. Do you have to show really good credentials? I mean, how do you manage to get posted here, or is it unusual?
I went through a process where you send your application in, you send a resume, your university background, etc. So I was set up with an interview with the coordinator that I'm now working for, and ask certain questions, find out your skills so that they can put you in an area that you can really develop at your capacity and et cetera. So, yeah. Mm. But it's a real blessing being here. And even though I'm volunteering, I'm so overwhelmed by being here and the work that we're actually doing. It's a real blessing.
Mm. Nagme, tell me about what work you're doing here.
My work here is around recruitment, so I'm involved with bringing in over 200 staff from all around the world, from over 85 countries, serving here every year. We have about 700 staff in total, but every year we bring in about 200 new, because our terms of service are such that people are here for a year, 2 years, and so we need to replenish the people that go.
Is it standard then to sort of serve for a period of time as a volunteer?
That's right. It is standard to serve here for a short period of time, relatively. There are those that serve here for longer periods, but it's really a blessing and an opportunity for us to have more people coming through and experiencing this, as well as having new blood here.
Well, when you are volunteering, how do you live? I mean, you're not earning money, so what keeps the bread on the table, as it were?
Our status here is that of volunteers. So our basic expenses are covered. So the Baha'i World Center takes care of our most basic expenses in relation to things like food and accommodation. So we don't have an extravagant lifestyle, but all our basic needs are met, and we are really provided with the things that we need to be able to do our service to the best of our ability.
Julia, is the accommodation together with other volunteers?
Yes, I currently live with 4 other girls, one's from Canada, Germany, Philippines, and another Australian. So there's 5 of us, different ages, working in different departments. So it's a real eye-opener because we're actually meeting a lot of people from different cultures while we're volunteering here.
And what do you think you're going to do when your term here is finished?
Who knows? It's 2.5 years away. But of course, I'll go back and start my career as a primary school teacher. But I'm not sure if I'll be going back to Australia now that I've met so many people from different cultures and there's so many places that we can go in the world and teach.
So would you be teaching then in the Baha'i educational system?
I'll be teaching as a professional primary school teacher in the education system, but of course there are so many opportunities to get involved with different Baha'i organisations around the world, which is of course something that I'm hoping to aim for in the future.
Is it sort of like being a missionary in a sense for the Baha'i faith?
No, to me it's not. To me it's really around learning an ethic of service and applying that in the work that we do. We're not here to preach, we're not here to do any of those things. We're really here to contribute through service. And for me, being here, it has really changed and completely transformed my attitude around what service is. Back in the day, I might have thought that it's a project that I do on the weekend or it's certain activities that I do or the good deed for the day. But being here and actually being involved on a day-to-day by providing this voluntary service, it is something that has infused into the way that I relate to people, whether it's my work colleagues or my friends. It's more of an attitude that I carry in everything that I do now.
Well, I wish you both well in your worldly pursuits, if I can put it that way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Julia and Nagme both expressed a desire to call not just Australia home, but the world home. And that encapsulates the message of the Baha'i faith. And don't forget to check out the pictures of the Baha'i Gardens on Mount Carmel in Haifa, Israel. They'll be on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Today's program was produced by me, with sound engineering by Jenny Parsonage. Let's hear now from the Baha'i Chorale. And until next week, so long from me, Rachel Kahn.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.
Thank you.